Going on, guys? That's weird. We're supposed to have an intro. There it is. I don't know. I kind of like these little intro things. Kind of sets the tone. In this case, it's literally Sunday. We're enjoying ourselves. Having our morning coffee. I see one of you guys is at church. And then I thought we'll go over one of the top texts. I kind of red pill you, starting from scratch. This one's Manuel Smith's When I Say No, I Feel Guilty. We're on chapter one right now, talking about fight, flight, or verbal assertiveness. Why is he on there? Oops. Hey, morning, guys. Hope you're enjoying your Sunday. I don't normally do these, but what the hey. Rolo's going on at noon. I'm going on at 11. And such a backlog of these things to get through. We figure we might as well get started now. Besides, most of you guys are either hungover or just got up or going to the gym anyway. So why not take this time and learn a little bit about what it means when people say that they're red-pilled. And by say, I mean actually are. So the book, When I Say No, I Feel Guilty by Manuel Smith. It's a second read. Usually go after this one right after Robert Glover's No More Mr. Nice Guy. And this one deals less with analyzing and critiquing the nice guy paradigm, which if you've talked about it before with me, it's if I do what I think other people want me to do, then they will love me unconditionally and I'll have a problem-free life. It's essentially dealing with that. Thank you. This one is more on assertiveness training. And I kind of prefer the book, but it's a much denser read. So we're going to try and get through one chapter per thing here. But at the same time, there's a lot to it. So he starts off with our inherited survival responses, coping with other people by fight, flight, or verbal responses. And he gives a bunch of long-winded, mystical explanations, very intriguing, some things literary, but mostly unnecessary. This is where this line came from, where guys complicate their lives without just for the sake of it. Here it is. So as he puts it, the merit of Joe's argument is as compelling now as it was 20 years ago, and I agree with it. Long-winded, technical, or mystical explanations are often intriguing and literary, but not only are they unnecessary, they actually complicate things without adding a jot to our understanding. To use what psychology does have to offer, it's more important to know what will work and why it will work. He goes through some examples here, but I'm going to skip to something that I learned early on. It was actually before I finished the book, which was nice because then I kind of caught on to the idea of it. It was that why is a really stupid question. And you're going to find most guys do this. I think Carl from Black Label Logic, he calls it stepping on your dick and analyzing the footprint. The old pickup guys used to call it mental masturbation. There's a tons of terms for it, but the key point to realize is our need to systemize things, which has only increased, is making it worse for us. We're so busy looking for details and nuance and the subtext and the second side of the story and looking how the watch is made that we forget what's right in front of us. It's like, is this making you fulfilled or happy? Is this succeeding in ways that you want to win? In which case, so often guys are so blind to that that they don't do what they're supposed to do. And obviously, you know, we'll get into the details of that anyway, but it's an obfuscation thing. And I would argue that Glover was onto something where it's an instinctive thing we do to kind of hide the evidence. So it's much easier to do these kind of analytics to complicate your lives than it is to address really hard decisions you have to make. Now, for some guys, I mean, I'll bring you an extreme example. I have a video on the channel about the story of True Datness. He was a married red pill guy, about the same kind of class as me. I like referring to him as like classes, but so he had finally kind of red-pilled his life. He kind of ended up getting divorced. He and his wife, he sorted that stuff out. He sorted himself out. He started getting new girls. He was very happy, but he never could not apply that same scarcity mentality with his daughter. And so he kept trying to buy her affections, doing the same way that you would want a girl's affection if you were like a horrible, unattractive man trying to buy affections, trying to negotiate desire. He was doing the same thing with his daughter. I don't mean that sexually. I just mean like every dad likes the love of his daughter. And his daughter wasn't putting up with it. She treated him the same way that anybody else getting ghosted because he was too much of a beta male would have been. And he got so mad at it, he kind of lashed out at everybody. He ended up being, he's the only guy who has had his flare removed. So he caught it, he understood it, he knew what he was doing, and then he removed it. And it's usually because of these same things here. Now, the scarcity, the anxiety over abandonment that Glover talks about here, that's normally a manifestation of the fight or flight response. Moving on here, so Manuel found, he found more and more experts in human behavior had the same coping issues as patients did. And this, like I said, I can't really start quoting a lot of stuff from this because this chapter is extremely dense and we're going to be here for like Rolo level hours. So I don't want to do that. I have a couple key parts I want to talk about, but for the most part, I'm just summing it up. Here he talks about a lot of guys who are in therapy as psychiatrists, psychologists, mental health, coaches, consultants, all this kind of stuff. And he notices that a lot of these people that claim to be able to help, that they're experts in relationship material, like they have the same problems as everybody else, which raised his interest because he's like, oh, that's funny. So these guys are experts in how to solve these problems, yet they haven't solved them in their own life. The part that I found it funny is this was within like the accredited medical sphere. So if it's happening here, it's very obvious that you get on your internet all your life coaches and your relationship dating coaches and coaches and all those guys. I have noticed in my tenure here, a couple years now, that most people who are claiming to be a way that they can fix your life, they can fix your relationships, they tend to have the exact same problems that they swear to God they're fixing. I always rag on her, but I don't want to single her out on this one. It's just an example that comes to mind. But Dr. Taylor Burrows, relationship coach, very good at what she does. She's got the PhD. She's got all the letters after her name. She's got the accreditation. But like that, the Taylor Burrows I know used to go by the name Dr. Babe. And she's never been in a long-term relationship or married. She's like in her 40s now. She was extremely hot. She never took any of the options she had because she was too good for all of them until it was too late. And now we're in this situation. I just find it weird that now you can claim to be an expert. Now, if it's consulting, that's fine. Information's information, but it's the coaching thing. And Manuel kind of noticed this himself. As he puts it here, placing all these experiences in perspective with a naturalistic observation of the thousands of other humans encountered in my lifetime prompts a sounder and more realistic conclusion. Not only is it natural to expect that we will have problems in living, it is also natural to expect that we will have all the ability to cope adequately with these problems. And as that second part there, I think it encapsulates, the red pill better than just about anything could. It's men swapping notes. And that always sounds like it's a nice catchy strategy. We say iron swapping iron too. Really taps into guys who know of it from its religious connotations, but that's really it. Human beings have not changed that much in the last couple hundred thousand years. So every problem that we're having today is a problem that somebody else had. And somebody else has usually solved it by now. And yeah, but they didn't have social media. They didn't have the internet. But I'm sure when the printing press came out, a lot of guys were saying the same thing. These girls are going to read books about Superman and they're not going to want to marry us. I guarantee it. So just take some comfort in knowing that most people made it all the way to the end of their life without too many problems. You'll be fine. That's where he gets into the guilt part of it. So he talks about ways of making us guilty without even knowing it, and constant questioning making us wonder about ourselves. This is the key to the lack of assertiveness in most men, and I would even argue women, but I'm here for men right now. Girls, if you want to listen in, feel free, fill your boots. If something good comes from it, great. But yeah, just don't take the front seats. Assertiveness is based on guilt. Like if you aren't extremely confident about your abilities, you tend to have that small insecurity about it. And when somebody tries to attack you by using guilt for this, it kind of taps into that insecurity, which makes it more likely that you're going to acquiesce on this, that, or the other thing. I'm sure tons of guys in the chat are going to have examples of this in their lives. But that's fine. For most of this stuff, you should be mapping it to your life and see where and where it does not apply. That's your part of it. So if we did not have an inherited ability to cope with all sorts of problems, human beings as a species would have died out long ago, which is true. For the most part, a lot of stuff we have instinctively internalized at this point. Like how to raise kids. That's an instinctive thing. Pretty much all problems, all psychological problems that people have nowadays, all intersocial problems we have nowadays, isn't nature. It's nurture. It usually involves somebody being taught a completely wrong set of tools. It involves a lot of people gaslighting, all those tools. So that's a good thing. So what can be learned can be unlearned. Now, there's always the argument about looks maxing, and that's off topic, but I'll just say this. Most people are attractive enough to get somewhere. And for those few that aren't, well, I guess you better start making your fortune. I can't help if you're that far along, but most of the people complaining about how far back they are aren't that far back, because the people who are actually truly behind the curve when it comes to like physical appearance, they tend to have a more positive attitude about it, because I mean, what else can you have? So dealing back into the coping strategies here, Manuel has a section. If you observe the major coping behaviors of the subhuman species, particularly the vertebrates, whenever there is conflict between two animals of the same species, you can usually see a fight or flight response on the part of at least one of the pair. Both fighting and running are very efficient ways for animals to deal with each other. And people, it's the same thing, but because we're a social species, like we're closer to bonobos than we are with the great apes when it comes to the evolutionary chain, we also developed sociability. And that's where verbal assertiveness comes in. So where normally scarcity, which tends to be fight or flight responses, that anxiety built up, that natural sense of fear or dread when things are happening, when you're going to have loss, a whole bunch of manifestations we can talk about here. But the point is, those fear-based responses, those fight or flight ones, are very crude tools, and they're instinctive on us. But our verbal assertiveness is what allows us to rise above it. So I'll use an example here. Let's say you're one of those guys that talks about logic and rationality. Well, here to tell you, logic and rationality are not actually our tools that we use to observe the objective universe. It's a great research paper that came out of Nature magazine that made a strong case that human beings aren't designed for realistic, like, objectivity. We're designed for subjectivity. So long as the subjectivity is easier to calculate than the objectivity, so it takes less energy to come up with, and it's replicatable. So a good enough strategy. We're the horseshoes and hand grenades of the scientific world, which is great. Point of that one is that these tools don't have to be 100% accurate. They only have to be useful. So when we're talking about logic and rationality, they're actually coercive tools. If a girl is threatened by men, and we're physically more imposing, so it stands to reason that generally women have to worry about physical danger in a way that men don't have to. So what they've done is they've developed sophisticated tools, guilt and shame and playing wounded and anger. They tap into our ability to want to be the protector of women. And they use all these tools to be able to carve out a very safe life, which is interesting. So that shows you that the power of verbal intercourse is strong if you're able to use it properly. So we're going to tap more onto this one. He expands further on it with fighting and running away from danger are responses inherited from our pre-human ancestors. Verbally communicating with one another and working out problems in an assertive manner instead of fighting or running away is part of our evolutionary inheritance passed down from early human ancestors. In short, you've inherited fight or flight to survive. You're not instinctively forced to do either. Instead, you have the human option to talk with others in a way to cope with what's bothering you. What you or I try to cope with is conflict in the modern civilized world. I want to preface this too, because I know reading this, most people are thinking, well, this sounds just like the exact stuff you guys have been rallying against forever, where communication doesn't work in a relationship and you talk too much and your feelings are bad. And that's true. That stuff is all true. We're not talking about that though. When he talks about verbal intercourse, I want you to interpret it as communication, but not verbal communication necessarily, because like I said, when it comes to something as simple as boundary enforcement, it's attention, affection, and commitment. You pull them commensurate with the boundary that the other person has crossed. Those send stronger signals than just about anything. So when I say communication, I want you to picture the entirety of your ability to act and speak, not just talking your way out of problems. Now, it's hard for a lot of modern guys because we're kind of taught the exact opposite. As it says here, as a child, I was taught that I should not fight, I should not punch other children in the nose. I was also taught that I should be brave and not openly run away from people who frightened me. Most middle-class children in Western society are similarly taught by their parents. We're trained to cope with conflict in a passive way. Don't fight back, stand there and take it. These are both passive modes. When someone makes us mad, for example, we rarely show it openly. Instead, we silently grit our teeth and make an empty vow of later revenge. There was a typical pattern shown by one of my patients, and he goes into it, but I actually love The Last Psychiatrist. If you haven't read... Actually, it's Hipsters with Food Stamps. I'll just go straight to that article. Absolutely wonderful one. Or no, it's the Guinness one. Real Men Drink Guinness. Search for that in your sidebar. Real Men Drink Guinness, Last Psychiatrist. And he catches on to this exact same thing. So I don't know when... I could go look, but I haven't done it now. When the book came out versus when the post came out. But this is all like a decade and some ago. He's talking about how advertising has shown us a reflection of our own psychology modern times. And this one, it's a bunch of guys in a wheelchair playing basketball together. And then at the end of the game, he shows everybody else but one guy gets up out of the wheelchair, then they go get beers. And that's a Guinness ad. Meanwhile, in India, it's the opposite thing. The one guy's like playing basketball with a bunch of guys in wheelchairs, and he's standing, and they all enjoy, so they're having fun. And he mentioned the kind of feminization that men have for this kind of stuff. And a part that I loved about it, where he describes like what kind of man likes the kind of ad where everybody hobbles themselves in order to play fair with their friends. And it's beta males. It's the best of men except for actual men. So what's a beta male? He's the kind of man who anxiously looks for something to identify himself as a man while doing nothing to become a man. For him, there's Guinness. He later goes on to expand that... add narcissism to this kind of guy, an unhealthy type of narcissism. And what does he do when he's confronted by a higher power? He seethes quietly and waits, looking for an opportunity to point out hypocrisy. It's so cathartic. And this is it. So these are those same passive assertiveness traits that guys are taught. And I know there's tons. I was the same way myself. I can vaguely remember in elementary school, some guy used to bully me. And then once I actually went and just fought him. I'm like, I'm tired of this. Went and did it. Both of us got expelled. Essentially, I got punished for defending myself. And from what I understand, things have only gotten worse since then. This is not a good thing for guys, because if you're not able to deal with conflict in positive ways, now I'm not saying everybody needs to go punch out everybody who wrongs them in world. I mean, there's world star hip hop to show you how smart that is. But the fact that you don't even have that in your lexicon of options, like if somebody truly crosses the line with you, yeah, you're completely justified to defend yourself. But instead, guys are taught to be little kiwi birds, no natural predators, openly run away, just sit there, quietly seethe, point out hypocrisy. It's like a very common thing right now that guys will look to point out somebody as a hypocrite as if that sorts out an argument, and it's very, like, that's the way of winning. It's a ridiculous thing to do, and especially if you're losing out on some kind of victory here, like a promotion at work, or a girl turned you down, went after your best friend instead. So anything there where there's like a zero-sum outcome, looking for hypocrisy is not going to get you a win. It's just going to end up making you lose with a little bit of nobility to you, minus the nobility. He again uses a bunch of examples of how this relates. Then adds on to it a couple... passive fight or flight responses. And these are the things to be aware of. And this is where he kind of hooks you. It's on page 7 and 8. What kind of passive stances do people have? In this case, sometimes it's dragging their feet, avoiding the other person. He uses an example here about an employee, Diane, working with her boss. And he started having a conflict with her over wanting her to do this, that, or the other thing. And so she would essentially do the slowest, worst job, like malicious compliance. And that was her way of dealing with this kind of conflict, which doesn't help. Obviously, from a company perspective, it just means a lot of people are being subpar. Now, there's an argument you can make as a leadership role that you shouldn't be creating conflict where you don't need to just to avoid these kind of things. But at the same time, from the employee standpoint, yeah, being passive ends up sabotaging you. Because if you notice this is her job performance. If you're dragging your feet on your job performance to avoid conflict with your boss, well, that comes back to bite you when if you're in a position where your job performance matters for bonuses or promotions or your resume. So this stuff's really important outside of just learning not to be a complete simp around women. 100%. And here's the other point. So here's what's going to separate verbal assertiveness from spurging out. And I think this is the part that everybody's going to want to watch. Verbal assertiveness doesn't have the same feelings attached. He elaborates here. So we only interact through aggression or flight. We also feel terrible since these modes of behavior always have unpleasant emotions of anger or fear associated with them. If we cope in these ways, not only do we get angry or afraid, but we usually lose the battle. And there are real battles in life to be won or lost with other people. We get frustrated and eventually sad or depressed. Now, we just did an episode on Friday where we talked about a Twitch streamer, very depressed, not getting any help from those around him, not taking any type of assertiveness in his own, really struggling to find love and belongingness in his life, and eventually he took his own life because of it. It's a very tragic event, but I guarantee you can map this to his situation for people who knew him close, and you're going to see situations where his need for passivity and not asserting himself caused situations where he eventually would lash out with that fight or flight response, eventually feeling sad or depressed because he knew it was an unwanted emotional state and it wasn't something he was under control of. It was dictated by the environment around him. That's something we refer to in this space as letting life happen to you, which is the absolute worst thing. As a guy, you're better off with a miserable life that you're in control of than letting life happen to you and hoping for the best. 100%. All right. Just realized I don't have chat open. I'm sure you guys are just killing it in the chat right now. Yes, you are. Awesome. Anyways, feel free. Hit like. We're going to continue moving on here. Now, I said this was dense. So this first chapter so far has summed up the instinctive and not quite instinctive methods that we have for dealing with other humans in conflict. That's fight, that's flight, that's verbal assertiveness. We've mentioned how fight and flight tend to be more instinctive and verbal assertiveness tends to be more social, so closer to the frontal lobe and not the limbic brain. At the same time, we've also established that communication is good, but communication isn't about talking about your feelings. That's what women and Oprah do. And Dr. Phil, I think, does too. Communication is about your actions as well as your thoughts. It's a whole concept called congruence, which is a key part of frame. At the same time, while fight and flight are instinctive responses that can have a purpose, you don't want to be the kind of guy who gets, you know, bullied and assaulted without defending himself. They also come with certain negative traits. In this case, usually anger or fear or sadness. And a lot of guys who end up using these things when they know there would have been better tools, like instinctively we would, they end up tacking on to it and giving us feeling of depression or sadness afterwards, which ends up meaning that those instinctive tools tend to be very crude and only good when they have to be used. In all other cases, verbal assertiveness is way better as a tool. Next part. Depression. Like I said, this guy's really dense. So he goes into all this stuff and then he goes straight into depression and the purpose of it. We'll do a quick segue though. So as he writes here, so when you see an unpleasant emotion, you usually sense the physiologic and chemical changes ordered by the primitive animal parts of your brain to ready your whole body for some behavioral response. In the case of anger, you're sensing your body's preparation for an attack. Not only can we feel this preparation of aggression in ourselves, but we also see results in the behavior of other people. For example, how many championship football games have been upset in the big game because some underdog team outplayed them, their traditional rivals, and then after the coach insulted and abused them in the locker room, they tend to do well. Our emotions have a purpose. I know everybody's saying, like, I always say, like, you should feel bad for having emotions and, you know, don't have them, but it's not that they're useless. It's that they have a purpose, and if you're not using them for the right purpose, then they are bad. In this case, anger is great as a social emotion to address a grievance. Social, and the nuance here is I'm talking like a serious grievance. Somebody hits you in the face because they don't like you. Yeah, anger exists because it's going to up your adrenaline, allow you to defend yourself, and basically socially signal to other people that if you attack me, I'm going to hit you back, which makes it much less likely that people are going to cross that boundary. Another complimentary read to this one is David Dutton's Wisdom of Psychopath. It's absolutely wonderful read. There's a section in there where he talks about how men, psychopaths, when they go to pick a target, if they were going to mug somebody or assault somebody, and they would show them pictures of or videos of people walking down the street, and it was amazing. Didn't matter who it was, but all the psychopaths picked the exact same targets, and they said that they looked like a guy who I could mug and get away with it. So there's the thing, and a lot of martial arts guys will probably know this one too, that by having control of your anger and understanding its purpose and being willing to use it in places where it matters, like I said, self-defense is the perfect example, you actually make it less likely to have conflict in those areas. Martial arts knew the same thing. A lot of guys will learn, they'll get their black belt in Taekwondo or whatever, and what they found is they usually, like a lot of younger kids, will get bullied, and that's why they want to learn martial arts, so they can learn to defend themselves. And then they find, as they get better, less people mess with them. And it's strictly in the way that you carry yourself. You've just signaled to the world that I am not to be messed with. And that's an interesting thing, because it makes sense why when you would see somebody who you would consider having a preponderance of alpha behaviors that walk soft and carry a big stick thing. It's a great conflict resolution tool, by the way, is just looking like you aren't to be messed with. And the easy thing I can tell you right now to tell if you're one of those guys or not, if you have to tell somebody not to mess with you, then you look like you could be messed with. The guys that don't even say it, those are the ones that you don't want to mess with. They don't get razzled. They don't get frazzled. They don't show anger. And that's the beauty of not showing anger. When you show anger, that shows that somebody's crossed the line. Most people don't. If somebody hasn't crossed the line and you show anger, you show your tolerance for conflict is extremely low, and it makes it more likely for people to experience conflict with you in the future. Moving on to fear, though. So whenever you feel afraid, on the other hand, you sense a physiochemical change ordered by your primitive brain that automatically prepares your body for running away from danger as fast as possible. Our chances for survival are better if we run away from a danger that cannot be dealt with than by talking. If a mugger approaches you with an open switchblade knife on a dimly lit street, that panicky feeling you sense in your breathing, your gut, and your limbs is not cowardice, but a natural feeling of arousal automatically triggered by your brain centers preparing your body for fight or flight. I always found it very telling how he mentions like cowardice there, because I notice a lot of guys will use the same three words in an attempt to shame men into certain behavior. There's honor, cowardice, and courage. Realize that those are kind of container words. They're all just filling emotions. First off, it's usually somebody describing they want you to do something and they don't know how to get you to do that, so they attack you by using guilt. Because you don't want to be a coward. You want to be honorable. You want to be courageous. So yeah, I'm going to do those things. It's like Marty McFly. Call him a chicken and then he'll do whatever you want. It's a very easy way to be manipulated. And so dealing with your insecurities, aka Glover, allows you to better equip yourself to deal with assertiveness in these situations where somebody calls you out with one of these kind of guilt-shaming tactics, where you could either laugh it off or just through your body language know, like, is he really trying to mess with me? Like, does he want to start something? In which case, it's something simple like, hey, how far do you want to take this one? And it's like an honest question. You're not mad. It's like, am I having to defend myself here, or are we backing this off, or what's the deal? And that's a nice little face-saving technique you can use to get out of a lot of those kind of situations. I like to, so I put another section in here about anger. So when a dent mysteriously appears in the fender of my brand new car, it doesn't help me to be assertive to someone who isn't there. I get mad as hell no matter what I tell myself. Here's the thing. People have a really bad understanding of anger versus rage. Rage is like a limbic brain thing. That's, remember that old video of the guy, I can't remember who the kid was, but like his brother deleted his Warcraft account or something like that, and he goes into his bedroom and he starts just like flailing about. He sticks like the remote control up his butt and everything. Absolutely hilarious old school meme. But that's the difference between anger and rage. Anger is a social emotion. Anger has to have two things to it. It has to have a grievance and it has to have purpose. So his example there, if somebody dented his car, he may be irritated, he may be disappointed, but he's not angry. But if he sees somebody take a hammer to his car, he's angry at that guy. Again, that's a social signal saying, I am not putting up with you hammering my car, and this anger is getting me ready to beat the tar out of you so you get the hell away from it. It's a strong social signal. It lets people know not to mess with you. Now, from a sexual standpoint, here's the caveat to it. In co-ed spaces, girls are a little bit jittery. They don't like anger, because anger means violence, and girls don't win in violence. They just don't. Problems with anger is when you're in a co-ed space, you're actively signaling a display of lower value. It's not even whether, like, some-wise it could be good. It's that you're signaling unattractiveness. Now, I know we got a bunch of examples of guys getting into fights and girls, like, falling out of love with their boyfriend when he gets knocked out and stuff like that. That's a different thing. So that's, they really don't like violence, but they like somebody who could be violent towards them. So if you end up in a fight, yeah, it's unattractive to be violent, but it's really unattractive to be violent and lose. So just keep that one in mind. Moving down here. So his next point is that the beauty of assertiveness is that it's something you're born with. It has to be trained out of you. Parental techniques are what make us worse. And this is what I was talking about before. People actually have trained us to be worse at life and adulting. And this is like, thank you, boomers. You really solved the problem. Anyways, one last touch on depression, though. So for our early ancestors, depression was a beneficial state for when they had to put up with a period of harsh conditions in their environment. When things got rough, they had to withdraw to retrench. Depression, people talk about it like it's a disease, and it's not. It's not a disease. It's what I would refer to as a form of modern diabetes. I've made the case. I've talked about it a bunch. You guys have probably heard it a dozen times, but as a species, we are hardwired to search out for, like, simple carbohydrates because we need the energy to hunt lions and tigers and whatever else cave people hunted. Had to chew on a sugarcane for 2-3 hours. We eventually get enough. It was great. People were still jacked. Everybody looked like Mr. Olympia. Hunting went well. Add the Industrial Revolution to it. We're now able to concentrate sugar into small cubes or sugary drinks. People still have that hardwired need to have sugar, but now what it's doing is it's causing problems. You can usually, and this is actually, here's a funny thing. You will always find, and economists and geostrategists, they always find that the difference you can tell when a world is, when a nation is developing to when a nation has become developed, is the increase in diabetes. It's literally a disease of the well-off. And it's a great example of how our instincts are not necessarily working well for us. In this case, depression. Yeah, if you ended up getting caught in a snowstorm, that's why seasonal affective disorder is a thing. Darkness makes us sad. These things exist because depression takes less energy than being excited. So when you have these things, you're able to slow down, conserve energy, and wait for things to come up. Perfect example, first day of spring. I can always tell when the first day of spring is because I wake up in, like, an extraordinary good mood, and I don't know why. The dogs wake up in a good mood. They start punching me in the face for 6 for breakfast instead of 6:30. Like, our environment affects us more than we know. And so I would argue for a lot of guys, and this is a little off topic, but for in cases of depression, this is why I constantly say meditation is worthless and working out is much better. First off, it's a change of venue. Secondly, you're getting outside of your own head and letting your environment work on you in a positive way. Thirdly, you have to go outside to go to a gym. You'll get some sunshine. And I know it sounds stupid and people have built up, like I said, very early on, like, to complicate their lives, overcomplicate things without having a single bit of understanding. Guys in the chat from that last video I was talking about there, talking about the how meditation was wonderful and it worked. And, you know, Byron was liking it. I'm like, obviously it didn't work. Like, obviously. Yeah, so this stuff sounds stupid and it sounds simplistic, but sometimes you need to stick to the basics. Cave people didn't have shrinks. Cave people had rocks and sticks that they lifted, and they had Cave Stacy around the way to smash. Stick with what works, and if that doesn't work, well, then we can advance beyond that. So going on, I do like, he always gives, like, a bunch of examples for this stuff, so that's why you'll see me, like, skimming a lot here, because we'll get to the point, and he'll mention 2 or 3 anecdotal stories of either his life or a client of his or some way of you interpreting it as a narrative, and it does it in multiple ways, so it's always much easier to understand things that way. It's a good thing to learn about how mental models affect us and how stories are very important. So back to it being trained out of you. Parental techniques are what making it worse. As infants, we're naturally assertive. Your first independent act as a birth was to protest the treatment you were receiving. It's crying is what he's referring to. If something happened which you didn't like, you let others know immediately by verbal assertion, whining, crying, or screaming all hours of the day or night. You were also persistent. You rarely stopped letting everybody know you were displeased until they did something about it. And this is always the good thing. Last psychiatrist, great part on this one as well. The greatest narcissist is a two-year-old. Because they literally don't have enough brain development to understand people outside of them as individual people. They just see them as objects in their life. There is nothing outside of his own ego. And like I said, it's something, like, it's nice to grow out of. You don't need a bunch of people walking around assuming everything else is just, you know, objects around him. But you do lose something when people train that out of you. Those same teaching strategies we were talking about before, parental strategies, same thing. And a lot of it's just because, I mean, we can narrow down some reasons. I'll give a few, but I don't want to give an exhaustive list. So let's say parents are divorced. Mom gets the kids because dad was working so much. The courts are like, yeah, you clearly don't love your kids because you only work 18 hours a day to support them. So we're going to give them to mom. She hates him and she does nothing but train her little special boy to be the man of the house and nothing like her ex-husband, her crappy ex-husband. She basically trains all these assertive features out of him because those are the things in the father that for the most part the girl was attracted to. So then you get to we're in like a second generation now. I'd argue millennials are the first. The boomers kind of trained them that way. And now the Gen X trained the Zoomers. And we've had two generations now of men that have been completely nutted by failed parenting strategies. It makes sense now when I see things like John doing his body language mastery course or Rollo doing an episode on some of the most basic stuff ever. And there's like a huge demand for it. So I don't even mean this to dunk on other people. That's not where I'm going with it at all. But like I said, some people just weren't given the tools, all the tools to succeed when they were young, and they're learning it as adults or young or late teenagers, and that's fine. You know, you got to learn it sometime, better now than never. So I'll never, as long as somebody is willing to learn, I would argue it's always good to have some patience. It's always the guys that are trying to use it as a crutch or as an excuse or just to constantly analyze things and overcomplicate the process. Those are the ones you really shouldn't waste your time on. That's why we always say this stuff is basically triage. So next part here, back into the parenting strategy. So these feelings are conditioned or learned variations of our basic survival emotions of fear. Once we have learned to feel anxious, ignorant, or guilty, we will do a lot of things to avoid feeling these ways. Our parents train us to feel these negative emotions for two important reasons. First, playing upon our negative emotions is a very efficient way of controlling our natural, annoying, and sometimes explosive childhood assertiveness. Yeah, that's mom nagging at you. That's what he's talking about. In using our emotions for controlling behavior, our parents are not necessarily uncaring, lazy, or insensitive to our wants. Instead, our assertiveness at that young age is readily mistaken by them for the innate, aggressive fight coping we show them when we're frustrated. Secondly, our parents use this psychological control method because our grandparents taught them to feel angry, ignorant, and guilty. Again, second generation in. And that's the problem. Mom is tired. Mom just wants to get her drink on. She doesn't want to deal with you. So she tells you, oh, you know, a good little boy would sit there quietly. Or, oh, why do you have to be such a little shit? You know, like Karen always rags about there. These coping strategies are actually horribly detrimental to the kid. But that's the problem, is that they aren't seen as negative. Like, if you were to hit a kid with a tire iron, you go to jail for that. And I think you should. But this kind of psychological wearing down, because it's not attached to malicious intentions, it just has malicious outcomes, are way more pernicious right now. And I would argue these failed parenting strategies, this Dr. Spock, you know, let the herd raise your kids, don't be assertive, get the dad out of the house, mom just wants to get her drink on stuff, like that stuff has really contributed to it. To what level, I don't know. I just know it is there. And now that you're aware it's there, you can deal with the fallout of it in your own life and how to, you know, shed them. So to continue here, our parents accomplish this emotional training in a very simple way. They teach us ideas and beliefs about ourselves and the ways people that produce feelings of anxiety, ignorance, and guilt. For example, Place yourself in the shoes of a young child, your own perhaps, or yourself when you were young. Take a look at the training you undergo. It's given by both parents, but mom usually has to do most of the dirty work since she is with you much more than dad. See, I love how he very subtle thing here. I know we were talking before about, like, I've just been talking about how great Glover's work is, but then on our podcast on Saturday, we were talking about how Glover himself, fairly blue-pilled, doesn't really understand a lot of what he's talking about. And this is one of those examples of it where right conclusions, but he misses some obvious glaring things. So mom has to do most of the dirty work. It's like dads tend to be more assertive, so they tend not to put up with this stuff as much. At the same time, divorces run rampant. So it's not that she's with you much more than dad. It's that, you know, we've decided as a system that mom gets to be with you more than dad. Dad has to go to work on the old two-parent nuclear family model too. So we've essentially removed dad from the home for economic reasons. I'm not saying they're bad reasons. I'm just saying this is the fallout of that decision. So when you clean up your room and you put all the toys away, mom usually says things like, "That's a good boy." And when she doesn't like the job you do, if you do it at all, she usually says things like, "What kind of kid are you? Only naughty children don't clean up their room." I notice he kept the swearing out of it because, I don't know, my mom cussed like a storm. You soon learn that naughty, whatever that means, applies to you. Whenever it is used, mom's voice and mood tell you that something scary and unpleasant may happen. She also uses words like bad, terrible, awful, dirty, willful, unimaginable, and maybe even words like wicked or evil, but they all describe the same thing. You. What you are, small, helpless, and not knowing much. And what you should feel, dumb, nervous, and frightened, and certainly guilty. Dude, this is... reading this for the first time has blown so many people's minds, you would have no idea how deep that rabbit hole goes. Notice he uses the categorical imperatives there. What you should feel. This is literally your parents filling you with an ideology to allow them to parent you easier. Again, not malicious. This is how it falls out, though. And this is the big difference between like good and bad parenting strategies. Good parents, and you've usually heard decent parenting advice talk about be consistent, have consistent consequences. Again, I'm going to link back to him because these guys are intertwined so much. Last psychiatrist, he was talking about that tiger mom thing that was around a couple years ago. Remember that? How Asian parents were just like beating their kids and they were end up being like excellent parents. So he brought up a case where the New York Times wanted to vilify this Chinese dad who basically was just, you know, beat his kid constantly, made sure he did the best. If he didn't get an A, time to get the stick, that sort of thing. And it sounded like horrible child abuse. Meanwhile, he put out another example of a tiger mom, like a Western-raised Asian lady who did all the same stuff, the yelling and the nagging, making him learn violin to get him into college, thinking that she was the same toughness that her dad was. But here's the thing. I'm not suggesting this as a strategy. I'm suggesting this to illustrate a point. So putting that caveat out there. When the Asian dad was beating his kids in this example, it was always consistent if it was for poor behavior. So the kids knew what was coming and they knew why it was coming and they had a structure, as horrible as it was. With a structure, kids are able to work their lives. If you take the example of, you know, mom has a bad day at the office and shakes out at her kids, or there was another example of a judge who was basically doing the same thing with his daughter, but he would do it based on his caseload that day. The problem isn't the violence, although the violence is horrible. The problem is the actions and the consequences. You can treat somebody horribly, but if you're consistent with it, at least that gives them enough structure to be able to cope with the things. Like they understand why the things around them are happening. Ideally, they wouldn't, but again, illustrative point here. So for a lot of parents, when they start attacking your character like this, and this is in the military, they taught us this all the time. Don't yell at the person, yell at the action. Always about consequence. So coming back to this point, a lot of these people would have been much better off learning assertiveness if it wasn't somebody doing something bad and like, that is wrong. That's bad. You did something wrong there. Go clean it up or have a consequence to it. You didn't finish your dinner, so we're throwing your Xbox out. Like the guy who shot his daughter's laptop, very consistent. Stay off of social media. Stop showing your cleavage out there to boys on the internet. And she did, and he shot the laptop. It's consistent. She knew what it was. She knew there was consequences. She's going to get mad about it, but she can work with it. But in these examples where you're talking to somebody and you give them a character attack, you are bad. You are terrible. You are awful. You are dirty. Example, example, example. These establish that men need to treat the important women in their lives as authority figures, which is a huge problem with being a nice guy. Again, very intertwined stuff here. So that's nice guy behavior. That's how it starts, by attacking you as a person. And you as a person are only a good person if you do what I want you to do. It's very, very subtle on that one, but it has large ramifications to it. This is where simping starts. The first simp always simped for his mom. I'll leave it there. So the thing as a parenting strategy, it's non-assertiveness. It's controlling behavior. He elaborates here that that's a good boy is very efficient, but it's manipulative, under the table control, and not an honest interaction in which mom would assertively, on her own authority, tell you what she wants you to do and stick to it. That's the key, taking responsibility. So I know I've talked before about how women will not hit on guys. They won't be the first to approach. They won't be the first to hit on them, with rare exception, because girls fear rejection. They hate rejection. They are terrified of rejection. Taps into a whole bunch of like caveman DNA in their blood. But that's the point. This manifests in raising kids way, or raising like young adults, even teenagers. Instead of just saying like, I'm your parent and you will do this because that's what I want you to do, and taking responsibility for it, they put it on the kid, where it's you're a bad person because this thing isn't done. It has nothing to do with what she wants. It's so weird, by the way, when she treats like the universe as the authority figure. Some, you know, everybody else is causing me to do this, not me. But it ends up, the guy ended up interpreting it as treating the girl as her judgment of his character. Yeah, it's one of those interesting things, and I wouldn't mind diving more into it, but at that point, it's not really solving the problem. Key thing to take away from this is just know that it's there. Just know, if you map this stuff back to your formative years with teachers, with parents, you're probably going to notice a lot of this stuff, especially if you're the kind of guy having these issues. He elaborates on it with, mom rarely tells you, thank you, I like it very much when you clean up your room, or even, it must really bug you when I make you do your room over, but that's exactly what I want you to do. With statements like these, mom teaches you that whatever mom wants is important simply because she wants it, not because you have to tie your identity as a human being to it. It's key there. If you notice too, so this is talking about like childhood and psychotherapy stuff. Map this to a girl who says a real man would pay for me and my kid, or a real man would take me out on a nice date, or you're just trash, like men are trash, like all that stuff. If you notice, it's the exact same thing. The only difference is whether it's coming from a parent or some thought down the street or a single mom across the way. And this is where it's important for you guys to use critical thinking skills, because we have, and this stuff has always been distilled, like to very pithy statements we use as like branding things online. Like a lot of this stuff, you'll notice Rich Cooper actually leans, I don't know if he reads this, but he leans heavily on a lot of the wisdom that comes from this, with a lot of his statements. And a lot of guys think, that sounds really good, that's cool, but you got to really look into it and truly understand where it's coming from to understand the depth in little statements. Like when Rich says, you know, put in the work. It's just one of those interesting things. Yeah, the new one. Here's the good one too, is Explosive Diarrhea. Why would you make that as your name? So Explosive Butt Juice says right here, yeah, it's like, you're just a fuckboy. That's another one. Totally good example. But there are no implications or unspoken threats that good children are loved and bad ones are not. You don't even have to like what mom wants you to do. You only have to do it. And that's the point. And this is where I would argue leadership as a man comes into play. And this ties into assertiveness training. A lot of guys are like, how do I get genuine desire? And we've kind of stoked that fire a bit. So, you know, mea culpa on that. Every guy wants a girl to truly desire them. That sexual energy, that sexual desire. I want her to do this for me because she wants to. And that's inside of her head, and you cannot control that. Where I make the argument is you don't want a girl to pair bond with you. What you want is compliance. You want her to make you happy because you want it. And she wants to make you happy because she wants it. It's not genuine desire. These are active choices. Now, the initial attraction is like a limbic brain response. There's nothing you control on there. But the rest of it is a pretty social thing. So once you're past that stage where you have that initial attraction, that what you would think of as genuine desire is, for the most part, leadership from a man's perspective. He's not saying good girls always go down in the morning, or good girls do this, or, you know, oh, don't be like that trash Stacy next door and do that stuff. No, it's, you know what, I really like when you make me sourdough bread, which I'm going to have in like a couple hours, which is awesome. I really like when this stuff happens. You're awesome when you do this stuff. You know what I mean? You're basically encouraging behavior, based on your own wants and desires. And if the other person truly cares for you, they will do those things, because making a man happy makes a woman happy, if it's a man she's really into. And again, that's that captain, first officer model. Different topic, different video. We'll get back to topic here. Children, unfortunately, are taught to respond to psychological control of their learned emotions of anxiety, ignorance, and guilt in many childhood situations. For example, if you're playing with your dog in the living room and mom wants to take a nap on the couch, she teaches you to respond to manipulative emotional control by saying, "Why are you always playing with Rover?" You then must come up with an answer as to why you're always playing with him in the living room. Chore play. This describes chore play. You know, if you just did more dishes around the house, then maybe I'd be comfortable enough and we could sleep together more than once every 6 months. Like, it's never, and it had nothing to do with that. It's just she didn't feel like doing the dishes, and she thought she could use these guilt-based manipulative techniques to get you to do more dishes. In reality, I mean, I've smashed tons of times while the sink's full of dirty dishes, so nobody really cares about the dirty dishes. It's not about that. And I'm sure you'll get a lot of girls that'll always tell you, no, maybe he's just a lazy POS and this, that, and the other thing. But that's exactly my point. There's no attraction driver there whatsoever. It's strictly a logistical thing. I want free stuff. I want labor for me. And I'm going to get it by telling you you're a bag of hammers until you do it. So part of this, again, stop listening to what women say and watch how they act. In this case, if you're getting true desire from a woman and she needs help with the house, you're going to notice that very clearly, because you're going to be smashing. You're going to have so much fun. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, I need help with the dishes. See what that means? I need help with the dishes because that's going to make me comfortable right now because I'm just dying. Or can you give me a hand with this? Or I need this. That's very, and a part of it is training. Because like I said before, girls have a real problem with taking responsibility for their own wants and needs. So in the same way guys are trained to be non-assertive, girls have it more innately. It's like the reverse of autism, I guess. So part of your role as a man in the relationship, and if you're talking about what value does a man bring to a relationship, this is a good one. Basically, you're adding enough assertiveness by making her safe around you. And this is where the beta comfort comes in handy. A lot of guys talk about alpha and beta. You just want to be all alpha. You don't need any beta. Well, beta is just comfort. And you do need it if you're going to be in a relationship. Whether you want one or not, irrelevant. If you're in a one-night stand, go all alpha. It's fine. If you want something past a year, yeah, you're probably going to have to sprinkle some beta into there. And that's fine. It's generally a reward for it. But it recreates that certain amount of comfort and safety that allows you to basically train the non-assertiveness out of your girl in the ways that matter. In these small little situations we've mapped out right now. Now, obviously, if you go overboard with that, you kill any sexual attraction. So it's a calibrated tightrope that every guy has to walk for himself. And this is a huge reason why I argue you can't just take what we're saying as sacrosanct. Don't listen to this. Read this for yourself, apply it for yourself in your own avenues, in your own life experiences, and you're going to see at what point something here is useful and something is not. Let me ask you that. How many guys giving you advice on the internet are telling you don't listen to them? So, and this is the thing. They put a pressure flip on you here. Though. Why are you always playing with him here? Why are you always out so late with your friends? Why do you not love me anymore? Not knowing any reason for the fact, other than the fact that you, that it happened and maybe you like doing this, or maybe it's fun, or maybe you like your guys, you feel ignorant, because if she asks for a reason, there must be one. So you guys will hunt and give a post hoc justification. And usually that ends up doing what's called dearing: defend, excuse, explain, rationalize. Those right there are supplicative tools. If you go back to my blog, there's a post on power games, a primer or a field guide, where you take human interactions, open and closed communication. Open communication, it's like how guys are talking, how I'm talking to you, sharing information. Very surface level, there's no subtext to it. It's literally the words imparted into your brain. Women don't use that. Women use closed communication. And a good way to think of, to conceptualize closed communication is put every conversation on an axis, a two-scale grid. On one axis is status, am I better or worse than this person? And am I for them or against them? Harmony and status. Dearing puts you automatically in supplicative territory. I think of myself as worse than you, and we're on the same team, so you're owed an explanation. It's like Rich says there. Here's the depth of that statement. If you treat a girl like a celebrity, she'll treat you like a fan. And that's exactly what he's referring to there. So in these situations, you're actually falling into traps, where you end up making yourself less attractive over time. And it's not like the girl's doing it on purpose. This is just instinct. This is how they were raised. This is part of their DNA. It's part of a conflict-averse nature. But it's kind of your job as a guy to just bat that stuff off and continue living in a way that, again, leads to a much better relationship. I hate to say it, like, girls are the gatekeepers of sex. Guys are the gatekeepers of a relationship. Then you add to that Brifolt's law. So long as there's benefit for a girl, she'll stay in the relationship. Part of that is, yeah, you just have to lead. These equality relationships, that's... when you hear people say that their relationship is equal and they should be equal, look back on this book and look back at this episode and these points, and you're going to see how evil of a statement that is, how manipulative of a statement it is, and what the outcomes are going to be of it. And it'll kind of let you look at these things in a whole different light. And it's not just like kids being raised up, and it's not just a dude married in a dead bedroom. Like, teachers pick up the slack where mom leaves off. They do the same thing. Because it's less work on their part. They load the kids up with Ritalin. They call them bad students, problem kids. Your own early manipulations, for example, sound like, "Mom, how come sis always sits in the room playing when I have to clean up the yard?" Critically suggesting that mom is playing favorites. At this young age, you haven't yet learned enough about manipulation to be a match for your mom. She won't be that facile until you're a teenager and want your own car, or the use of one, or to stay out late on dates, or any one of 100 other things. But by then, you're slick enough to play on your parents' learned feelings of anxiety and guilt. That's the same thing. So it's a natural part of human behavior, where a lot of teenagers end up doing in this parents, especially divorced parents, where they weaponize mom against dad. "Well, dad always gives me this stuff. He's such a better parent than you." Like, that's the chickens coming home to roost on failed parenting strategies on kids who become teenagers. It's just one of those things to realize. But realize at the same time, you're not creating a healthy environment and your relationships will suffer. God knows I've seen enough girls with daddy issues and enough guys with mommy issues to know that, yeah, this doesn't end well. And it's probably best if you don't do it, even if it gets you what you want in the short term. So, but in the meantime, your first manipulative attempts are quite sufficient to make mom feel defensive or protective about herself. I'm sure a lot of guys here have noticed that too, like with their moms, a lot of guilt trips, especially as they get older. You don't visit enough, this, that, and the other thing. But yeah, teachers pick up the same roles. You know, go to the principal's office. You've been a bad student. Here's some Ritalin. I just want you to sit there and be quiet. All the stuff Rollo talks about when he talks about men being raised as defective women. Well, it's essentially non-assertiveness training that parents have used in their failed parenting strategies picked up by the education system, which again, predominantly staffed by women now because of that whole scare that, you know, male teachers are diddling the kids and they're slowly being edged out of the space. He brings up a bunch of stories afterwards about the moms doing the teaching, doing the same thing. So second, all the mothers erroneously assume that if they decide to assertively take charge, they will only have two options, being tyrannical bastards or indulgent deli fists with their kids. I like this line when he goes into it because this is that boss bitch phenomenon. Girls think that if they want to hang out in a man's world, they have to be prickly and ornery and completely bitchy because that's how you do it. And this goes to show how men and women aren't the same. Like women, they see men acting assertive and they don't know how to process it. So to them, it just looks like being bitchy and that's how they act on it. Again, for those same reasons of those risk avoidance, risk tolerance levels of men, the lack of emotions that a man has because of increased testosterone, all that stuff. So when you see most women assume you have two choices, you either be a floor mat or you got to be a boss bitch. That just shows you that they haven't actually developed the certain assertiveness skills that they need. I know we've talked, Peterson talks about it a lot before he went down that whole rabbit hole where he had a lot of female clients when he was in clinical psychology. And assertiveness training was probably the major thing he had to train them. Like, say what you want for the plight of men, and we got it bad, and I'm here for that. But just be aware, from the female perspective, the lack of assertiveness and understanding of what the term even means is like the huge plight of women today, which is why women be bitches is such a common term. And most of them are, because they don't know how to be assertive without being one. Which should help, by the way, taking this back to what's in it for us. If you're a guy and you're seeing a girl trying to act all bitchy and think she's acting like a weird man, like, why are you so weird? Your natural response then isn't to get aggressive back to her. Those fight or flight responses. It's not very attractive, but at the same time, you're really missing the subtext and you're playing to the surface level, open communication style of it, as opposed to the subtext. When a girl starts chirping off like that, it's not actually a dominance play like you think it is. It's a girl who doesn't know how to be assertive, who's play acting or LARPing it. So what that really tells you is on that status spectrum, she actually thinks of herself as lower status than you, and she's not on the same team, which gives her like that insolent attitude. Which is good though. So as a guy, you realize, okay, she thinks she's worse than me and she's not on my same team. So I can either disengage, which you should. If somebody's not on your team, why are you wasting time with them? But that allows you to do, again, agree and amplify or amuse mastery, which is putting yourself at, I'm on the same team and I'm better than you. The idea here is if you have the stronger frame, you tend to pull the other person into a complementary space, which in this case is submissiveness, or I'm on the same team and you're better than me. That's the beauty. That's why we say frame is so important. These like, and these aren't mental games like, you know, chess, or it's not like a game and A equals B and C equals D. It's a very fluid, subjective thing. And the dynamics largely play out subconsciously. So all you need to focus on from a guy's perspective is having a solid set of frame, good assertiveness skills, and then to be aware of what the other person is trying to express past the surface level of just the words. And I guarantee you, all these guys talking about how women ain't shit, if they start looking at this stuff properly and applying the frame in their own life and being enough physically attractive to make a girl think of them as her best option, I guarantee you'll notice the behavior of women changes dramatically. That's why Karen is such a thing. Karen is the middle-aged soccer mom, sexually disgusted by the guy she's been saddled with. And that's usually why they end up lashing out at everybody. But something for another topic. I think I see it for quotes. Good. I guess we'll sum this one up. So we started off understanding the concepts of fight, flight, or verbal assertiveness, and why verbal assertiveness tends to be a lot better. I would consider verbal assertiveness to be a closer statement to frame than actual verbal assertiveness, because it implies a whole lot of other non-verbal cues. We got into why fight or flight are not necessarily good for all kind of engagements. They come with all kinds of baggage attached to it, including depression afterwards or sadness. There's a physiological need for that stuff in times of crisis, but in this modern age of abundance, it tends to be counteractive to us. Changing your environment tends to be a really good way of dealing with that, as opposed to meditation or pseudoscience or living inside your own head, building it up as a feedback loop. How somebody becomes non-assertive over the years, because you start from a very assertive, narcissistic state, and then that's slowly weaned off of you as you get older. Largely by women, and the removal of men from children's formative years has increase the propensity for this. It's kind of like what I talk in my article, is Thotrazone right for you? These kind of situations, they don't look at it from the surface, but they have long consequence tails. In this case, removing the father from the home in such massive levels has created a lot of non-assertive boys. Women are raising defective men. Then at the same time, a little bit of empathy there. Understand that girls not only have the same non-assertiveness skills, but they don't even have the mental firmware to be able to understand what assertive means, which allows you to see very aggressive behavior from girls towards you in a much different light, much less adversarial and much more like watching a tiny little chihuahua barking and yapping at you. Now, if he was a Doberman, you'd be a little freaked out, but it's a chihuahua. Oh, that's adorable. Pet him on the head. He might nip your finger, but you're like, ah, whatever. Just don't take him too seriously. But so that's the sum of this one. I'm going to go through the chat now. I see I missed at least one super chat, and then we're going to call this episode. I'm trying to keep these under an hour. This one went slightly over, but Manuel really is a dense read. So we got, I think, 9 more of these. Adriano, thank you for the $2 super chat. Do you really believe in Brifalt's law? I'll put it this way. Whether I believe in it is not the question. Is it a useful framework? Yes. I'll use an example for this one. So if you guys don't know what Brifalt's law is, that means that the woman is the deciding factor in the terms of the animal relationship. When there's no benefit for the girl, there is no relationship exists. I'll put 2 scenarios in your head and let you guys come to your own conclusions if it's a good enough analogy or not. Let's say you're in a relationship where the guy doesn't want to be in it and the girl does. What percentage of those marriages will stay together? And alternatively, let's say there's a marriage that the guy's perfectly happy with and a girl's not happy with. What percentage of those will stay together? So that should help answer your question, Adriano. Anyways, thanks, guys. Enjoy this one. I'll set up the next one. I'm going to go for a bike ride enough, so I don't know when I'm setting the next one up. But you'll, like, just keep in tune for it. Smash the like button. At the very least, hit subscribe. I think the notifications icon. So you'll see when I put these things out. The second one's going to be awesome. It's the title of it is Our Prime Assertive Human Right and How Other People Violate It. Basically, a roadmap on how people fuck with you. And I could swear to God that 99% of the people who talk shit on Twitter would probably learn so much more from this than just about anything else they're consuming on the internet. So on that note, thank you guys. Like I said, I'm going to read through these chats a little later. Sorry, I don't have a time to do it while I'm going through the lesson plan here, but on that note, I'll catch you on the next one.